Welcome to part two of the Guardian Ashes Weekly. Jeff, I stopped you mid-flow there to do a badly delivered transcendent state gag, which I've badly delivered again. What did you want to say?
That's all right. No, I'm very zen about all of it, Max. I just something about the line about lessening cognitive load just makes me think about the kind of trend to have people just pumping everything through ChatGPT or, you know, shitty AI models that don't actually have any intelligence. They just regurgitate slop. If you're outsourcing thinking to someone else or to the machine, then you're not getting better at thinking. You know, you have to, it's a muscle. You have to exercise it. And it seems like that's a factor. It's a really interesting observation that Archer is the one who seems the most self-sufficient and can figure out how he needs to shift his game at different times. And, you know, there was so much talk about the fact that he bowled quickly in Brisbane. Yeah, because he knew he only had about 15 minutes in which to bowl. So he went all out. Whereas if he's lining up in the first innings of a test match, he might have to bowl 40 over. In that test, of course, he's not going to be coming in and going at absolutely full tilt. And he doesn't need to go at full tilt all the time because he's a very skillful bowler in other ways. And this Adelaide test felt like a letting down of Archer in that he does the work. He takes the 5 for 50 in the first innings, keeps things vaguely manageable, and in return he gets to come out on the same day and bat for an hour and a half at the end of the day in that 40-degree heat and then continue batting for another hour the next morning. So he's got a team that wasn't supporting him, particularly from the batting side. It's, you can't take away the responsibility to think through things. And the comparison with Broad and Anderson is a really interesting one where they basically coached each other. They always made sure that, you know, whoever wasn't bowling was at mid-off or mid-on so that they could be talking constantly about what the ball was doing, what lengths they should be bowling, what they needed to adjust as they went. And this current bowling attack, they haven't played together before this series. And so they don't have that kind of rapport, but there didn't seem to be a lot of communication between them either. And maybe it's just down to dumb luck at times. You know, Bryden Cass has bowled far, far better at other times than he has in this series. He's still picked up a bunch of wickets, but largely because he's been getting slapped into the deep and picked up people hitting out. But I don't know if you could predict that he would have bowled as erratically as he has through this series based on previous showings. But yeah, I think broadly they picked mostly the best players available with the seamers. I'd agree with that. I think their spin selection was a major problem, and that was always likely to be exposed with Bashir being so inexperienced and the fact that they're not game to pick him and they don't have anybody else, where there were a couple of other spin options who might have been able to do something.
Ben Stokes, Ali, he wants to stay on as captain. It feels like, you know, you talk about Anderson and Broad and missing these sort of experienced players, and lots of experienced players, you know, have left the squad in the last couple of years or so. He looks so exhausted all the time because he sort of has to do everything. Like, he is talismanic. As a fan, you love to watch him, you know, just grit it out there at the crease. But has he had a good series? I mean, but is there so much pressure on him? Does he have to do everything himself?
I mean, there is a lot on him. And actually, we saw in this test match, I mean, before this test, I was saying that I was concerned about him being one of four seamers. I think that puts a lot of pressure on him to essentially bowl 20 overs in innings, which I think physically asks a lot of him. The way he's looked to bat in this series as well, particularly since everything's gone down the gurgler, pretty much from the last day in Brisbane, is that he is now sort of digging himself into a trench. And he's very good at that. He's got a kind of technique that does pretty much stand up to scrutiny at number six there. But I think it does take an immense amount out of him. And we saw that when he sort of, you know, I'm now going to get confused with my days. Was it day three when he was essentially unable to bowl? He just couldn't bowl himself. Yep. He had wrecked himself mid-game, which was always my concern that was going to be the case. And actually there was, you know, when that early wicket fell, Weatherall shouldn't have been out. It was pitched outside leg, but the umpire gave it anyway. But Australia were actually a very similar position to where England were in Perth. They were 100 runs ahead, but one wicket down. And that there was a moment there where England could have applied the thumbscrews and, you know, really tried to chisel out some Australian wickets there. And with Stokes kind of ailing in the field, unable to bowl himself, and some really strangely passive field, particularly to Usman Khawaja, who's, you know, quite a shaky starter when he comes in. And with the spinner, you know, a guy that can't necessarily land it on a spot, you know, six balls in a row, the pressure was released so easily. Has Stokes had a good series? I mean, he would probably hold his hand up and say no, because he will feel like he could have done more. But at the same time, so much gets asked of him in that role that I think there is a limit to what at 34 he can achieve now.
Before we talk about Australia, who were also there in these three test matches, what happens now? Does McCullum go? Does Rob Key go? Does anyone go? Do we rip it all up?
Well, I think Matt Hughes and myself, to an extent, we've done a story overnight that the I think the ECB is looking... I think they're wary of the fact that every time an Ashes tour, you know, sort of blows up, that there is a huge sea change in philosophy and, you know, jobs are detonated left, right and centre. And I think at this stage, and, it, you know, things could get worse and this picture might change, but at this stage, I don't think they're looking necessarily for absolute wholesale change in every position. I just wonder, I made the point in one of the other pieces I wrote yesterday, was I just wonder whether we have reached a stage similar to where Australia were, although albeit with results much poorer, but and they're very different people, but Brendan McCullum and Justin Langer. Now, they both performed a role at a moment in time, and I think in both cases they did an excellent job. They were what that team required at the time. For Australia, it was picking up the pieces from sandpaper, trying to restore some of their kind of, you know, it wasn't just PR, it was about restoring the kind of earthiness of where their cricket had come from. They'd lost sight of who they were as a team. And I think the same can be said for McCullum in that early sort of year and a half, that they were such a downtrodden, conservative-looking side that you really couldn't get out of their bunker, and I do think that McCullum breathed life into it. Now, in that instance with Langer, is that they hit a point, and Pat Cummins, as a captain, hit a point where he realised that this team needed something new. It needed a fresh voice in the dressing room. It probably, for them, it was a case of needing a calmer, more methodical coach, someone that didn't make the players feel sort of so hothouse as they did. And he, you know, Cummins, he's a charming guy. He smiles at you, everyone. He's a lovely bloke. But he was ruthless in that moment. He pushed for change internally, and he got the change that he wanted. And I'm just wondering whether, particularly the way that the messaging has kind of diverged in the last week or so, is whether Stokes and McCullum are still on the same page. And I suppose just a very small point. I mean, you mentioned about let's try desperately not to be looking forward to never writing the word Bazball again. That wasn't a word that McCullum ever asked for. I think it was put on him. I feel a bit sorry for him in that respect. But essentially, that word will continue while he's in the job. And that does make you question whether that he is someone that can stay with that if you're going to have a kind of clean break. There is a complication, however, because Rob Key, in my view, made a mistake in giving him the white ball teams, is that there is a World Cup just, you know, coming a couple of weeks after this tour. You have a tour of Sri Lanka, and that leads into a T20 World Cup. So in terms of there being any sort of immediate regime change, I can't necessarily see a sort of a button being pushed. And who knows, maybe they'll go on and win that. It's such a capricious format, T20. It's not beyond the realms, albeit their white ball form has tanked under McCullum. But I don't know. It might not be an immediate change, but to think that the status quo can hold is unrealistic.
It'd be fun if there was another Barry, a really conservative Barry that came in, and it could be a new Bazball.
I can think of one Barry.
Yeah, me too.
Was it Barry from EastEnders?
Oh, well, two Barrys.
We're going to do it anyway.
Barney, what do you think should happen at the...
Well, the problem is, I think the McCullum project is done. McCullum was a one-week course in motivational speaking that got out of hand. It's like Tony Robbins is in charge of ICI. Like, just get him in for the corporate away day. You don't need to hear that message again and again and again. You need detail as well. You know, I agree with Ali. There were some, it was, you know, it was refreshing and fun. And I think Stokes has internalized the things that he learnt from McCullum, which were of value. And I think for him as a person, that has been really useful. I'm not sure what relevance that has to anything other than Ben Stokes himself, but Stokes definitely not the problem. I don't think he needs McCullum anymore. And I think probably he is, well, definitely he is visibly distancing himself from that whole kind of approach. The problem with McCullum here is that it's going to cost a lot of money to get rid of him if it works in the way it does with other people in these kind of jobs where you end up having to pay out their contract to some degree. But I saw him on the outfield yesterday talking about staff, and I just thought, thanks, but you have to have someone in there. There's too much resources. This sport is so well-founded. People care about it. It has to feel as though it matters and that it's speaking to the people who love it and pay for it. And I did not feel that. And I felt like I've been at so many football things where it's just like, that's not working anymore. And if there is money available and a way of doing the most Baz thing now would be to resign, but that ain't going to happen. You can't expect that to happen. We'll see. But for me, it's done.
Yeah, it was bizarre to sign him to such a long contract so shortly before an Ashes series when you know that that tends to dictate careers. It's not always a complete bloodletting. Joe Root survived 2017-18 when they got smashed because there wasn't a better option for captain, and maybe that'll be the same for Stokes. But I think you're right that the McCullum message is stale. The thought process is just keep doing what we've been doing. It's something like picking Ollie Pope for the third test when he clearly wasn't right in those first two. There was clearly something not going right with his process, and he played like a guy who didn't remember what cricket was or that he had once been good at it. You know, it is a point where it's unfair on a player to keep picking them when they're not in a headspace to be able to succeed. And I think it's reflected in what we saw from a bunch of the assistant coach statements throughout that series. They keep putting them up for press conferences, which means you might want to think about what you're going to say. If you know that you're going to be the bad day assistant coach, you might want to ponder that beforehand and not go in and say something outlandish. But I keep coming back to Triskothic after the second test saying, we haven't talked to the batters about driving on the up and the fact that they keep getting out that way. Oh, well, no, we don't talk to them about it. We just rely on them to figure it out for themselves. Again, what are you doing there? Jeetan Patel during this test, just absurd press conference, absurd statements. Oh, Shoaib Bashir is our number one bowler. We haven't picked him for the first three test matches, but he's our number one bowler. These kind of just repeating of absolute nonsense statements by staff who don't seem to be able to articulate what they do or what they might do. If that's your entire coaching structure, that's all coming from the head coach. That comes from the top. They set that agenda. So why are you going to have someone whose approach to the whole thing is, it's all cool, we'll just pick the 11 that we thought we'd have when we came out here and we'll keep doing that and we won't try to do anything differently and I'm sure it'll all work out fine. You know, any one of us could get paid $1 million a year to do that.
I'm available. I'd just like to put it out there. Now, Jeff, Australia are good, aren't they? You know, Cummins comes back in. He's not fully fit, bowls brilliantly. Stark, the first cricketer, English or Australian, to score 250s and take 2 fivers in an Ashes series twice. Alex Carey is absolutely peerless behind the stumps. He's great with the bat. Khawaja comes back in. He scores runs. Travis Head is, you know, just... the field placing was odd for him, I think, but he still batted absolutely brilliantly. I don't know where you want to start, but there should be a bit of this podcast, which is Australia are good and have been good.
Maybe a little bit. And also that they're good against the odds of being good. I was having this conversation with my two colleagues yesterday at the game about the Dad's Army thing. I think it was Ellie who was mentioning this, and how it's kind of true in that you've got, you know, Usman Khawaja limping off with back spasms. You've got Hazelwood, who doesn't make it to the starting line. Cummins with the back problem, who comes in for the third test. Nathan Lyon blows up his hamstring. Steve Smith gets dizzy and has to sit out the third test. Like, all of the older players have had at least points of dropping out of this series, and some of them for the whole thing. So in part that is true, but in part they've also been able to use the experience they've had to play as well as they have. And yeah, the defining one for me is Cummins. With all the talk about preparation and figuring out how to bowl, the guy hasn't played a test in 5 months, hasn't played a single lead-up game, didn't get any shield games, didn't get any warm-up, didn't get any, you know, nothing to get his bowling back in the groove. All of that talk of how to make it second nature, it's clearly second nature to him because he comes in and hits the right length immediately in Adelaide and picks up wickets. Knocked the top off the second innings as well. You know, a bit of help from England in terms of shot selection, but it's because he's so consistently at batters with a length that he's going to be nicked into the cordon and a line that means that you're very likely to be drawn into playing at it. So it's that consistency of purpose from Australian players. Stark has obviously been outstanding, 50 wickets this calendar year at 17, I think. And, you know, even Lyon for that burst before he blew up his soft tissue injury, he was just getting it on the spot. He was putting revs on the ball. He was turning it substantially. He was varying his pace. He was doing all the things you want a spinner to do. So you can have older players and they might have some drawbacks with fitness, but if they've still got the ability to perform at the level they need to when they have the chance to do so, that's what we saw Australia do. That's what we saw Khawaja do in the middle order because he didn't have to open. It made it a bit easier for him as a bad starter, and he got a few favours along the way from England. So, yeah, they're just a remarkably consistent, professional, hardened team, and I think that needs to be the model that an England side needs to look at if they want to come down here and actually have a hope of competing.
One thing, Ali, that I've, I can't remember who was saying it, but in terms of preparation, the sort of, the cricket matches that are offered to you to play, the fact that the series are, certainly they're one side in Australia, right? England haven't won a test match here since January 2011. Australia don't do well in England either. Do both the ECB and Cricket Australia need to come together to sort of make both series more competitive? Like, is that important for the future of cricket? Or is it, you know, it's still popular. People still like it. It still gets crowds, even if they're quite one-sided.
Yeah. And you sort of get this response, don't you, that why is all this hype about this series when it's so uncompetitive when England go into Australia? But when people say that, I just think you have no soul. This means so much to so many people. In terms of preparation, I suppose, yes, I think all boards to a degree have been guilty of this in the last sort of 10, 15 years of the kind of race to the bottom in terms of, you know, really going out their way to not help their guests get ready for what is, you know, the big money spinner series. And that's in terms of facilities provided, opposition that you put up. You know, you can go to India and find yourself warming up on a green seamer and then plunged into a spin thing. It used to be the old way in Australia. The last tour game before Brisbane would be in Hobart. So it would be like, you know, you'd be a sort of crab taken out of the freezer and then dropped into the, you know, into the boiling water sort of thing. So I'm not chucking shade at Cricket Australia here. I think all boards have done it. In terms of the negotiations for this particular tour, it's very murky because I don't think England are sort of ECB are trying not to sort of whinge. I think they probably has been a bit of, I think they probably dropped the ball in terms of their requests, whether they could have requested and got exactly what they wanted. I don't know. We spoke to Todd Greenberg, who's the CA chief exec, before this test match, and there was a kind of concession that the two boards will be coming together to try and basically help each other out a bit more, because I think they are aware, as much as everyone sort of is chasing the T20 money train, that you know, test cricket, particularly in England and Australia, is what pays the bills still. That is what people are invested in. It's what people buy tickets for. We've just seen, you know, 200,000 people have come through the turnstiles at Adelaide Oval this week. It's a record crowd for this ground. This is the cricket that people care about. But you're right, if the product sort of diminishes over time, then, you know, the whole thing will fall apart, really. I suppose the big difference would be that county cricket does allow a lot of Australian players in between Ashes series and in their off-season to come and experience English conditions and get better. Maybe that contributes to it in terms of Australia being a bit more competitive. English cricket is just clinging on to the fact that they haven't won a series in England since 2001. But let's face it, it has been way more competitive in England than it has been for England in Australia.
Yeah, and for that reason, actually, Australia should let England have better preparation before we reciprocate. That should be the fair way of doing it. Barney, is anything salvageable here? Like, England haven't won a test here since 2011, so winning a test, winning Melbourne, would be something, right?
Yeah, it would 100% be something, not least for the likes of us who are going to be there watching it and hoping to find... I mean, nobody enjoys this narrative. I mean, maybe that's incorrect. Maybe 30 million Australians enjoy this narrative. But it's become tedious. It's become boring. Baseball became boring some time ago because its method is so one note, but England losing is boring as well. It's not really good for anyone. Cricket Australia lost a lot of money by England losing so quickly in the first two tests. So they have got better as the series has gone on. I don't think it's necessarily because they abandoned their method or changed how they want to play or thought different thoughts. I think it's because they were short of a gallop and they've now played some warm-up tests, which they lost really quickly. I don't know if they will win a game at all. There might be some rain and we might get away with a 4-0. That would be my prediction.
And would you make any changes, Barney?
Yeah, I would 100% make some changes. I think Ollie Pope's had his go. I think that Ali's right that they do with another bowler. It's a shame Shreyas Bashir's probably missed his window. I'm afraid Jacob Bethel has to have a go now. Or you could pump Will Jacks up and move the whole thing up a bit. But they've left themselves no room to manoeuvre there.
Or, you know, bring someone in who's actually a batter from somewhere else, which, you know, there are some who exist. But I do find the whole dynamic of these series really interesting in terms of just how uncompetitive they've been for so long. You know, 2010-11 is the aberration, and then the few series before that are also absolute pastings. But if this were any other team, you know, West Indies got whitewashed 5-0 in 2001, and they never played a five-test series since. So, you know, they play two-test series now when West Indies come to visit. Any other team that was getting beaten this badly would be reduced But they still got 200,000 people through the turnstiles, knowing that this was likely to be uncompetitive, because Australians really like beating the shit out of England. It's not it's not unattractive. No, and I'm not even saying this to be snarky or no. funny. Like that sells in Australia, and I think because the series in England are competitive, so yeah, Australia haven't won there since 2001. But 2005, 2-1. 2009, 2-1. 2013, 3-0. But they had two winning positions rained off, and they could have won two of the other tests that were close on the last day. 2015 was 3-2. 2019 and 2023 were 2-2, and Australia retain. So you've got competitive series in England where Australia's been frustrated because they haven't won it, but they felt like they could have won it. They were close to winning it. And that pisses off the Australian cricketing public enough that when England come to Australia, they're happy to see 5-0. They don't find it boring or uncompetitive. They want to punish England for having not let them quite win the previous time in England. Like, that's where the competitive tension comes from. It comes from the English series, where Australians are more at home than English people are here, I suspect. And then the 5-0 becomes the revenge chapter every time, as it was in 06, 07, or, you know, the 4-0 that people are still annoyed about the fact that England snuck away with a draw in 2022 because there was a bit of rain in Sydney and Broad and Anderson managed to bat it out. So it's not unattractive to the Australian public to have a very, very uncompetitive series specifically against England, even though it's unattractive to have uncompetitive series against everybody else.
Cummins says he's probably not going to play in the next test. What other changes? Lyons going to be out. So what will Australia do, do you think, Jeff?
It's going to be interesting. We'll have a squad pretty soon, so we'll know. But, you know, three different spin options that, well, they've used Todd Murphy and Matt Kuhneman in recent times, but more so in Asian conditions. Corey Roccaccioli has quite a big reputation at the moment. He's been bowling well in the Shield, tall off-spinner, can bat. So there are a few options going around there. It wouldn't be beyond the realms that they might just stick with their squad and use the seamers, and you know, someone like Michael Nisa can effectively be a spinner in a way, can bowl long spells and get through overs faster than some of the other seam bowlers. But yeah, there'll be a slew of changes. You know, Stark and Boland playing four and a trot on the trot would be an interesting call, but I don't think either of them will be volunteering to miss out. So, you know, Cummins sitting out will be interesting. If you go back to a Doggett, Boland, Stark situation, yeah, there are still vulnerabilities. England have opportunities, but I just don't think they'll be in the headspace by now to actually make the most of them.
Finally, do you have any hope, Ali?
Well, I mean, I hope everyone has a lovely Christmas and New Year. and I also expect that whoever Australia bring into their side, that England will give them the best day of their life. So
that's nice. That is nice. It's giving.
It depends what pitch is rolled out of the MCG, what Australia wants to prepare there. And I'd hope for a bit of, you know, I think we could see a sort of seam-dominated game, potentially, particularly with Nathan Lyon out. And I have seen that Stark has said he's going to go again. And that is, you know, that's testament of 35 as to how he keeps himself in shape and ready for the big series. He's a phenomenal bowler. But in terms of England, I don't quite know where they go. Bethel is just the ultimate Hail Mary. And given where they were 12 months ago with him in New Zealand, and they liked what they saw, again, I think they blinked at the start of the summer when, you know, that if they wanted to invest in him, that was the time to do it. And asking him to come into this side now and sort of change things. He will be unencumbered, I suppose. He won't be as scarred as perhaps whoever he replaces, which I imagine would be Ollie Pope. But, I don't know. It's going to take a serious effort to get a win out here now.
Sure, but from the cabin, he's seen the horrors of war and he just has a tiny musket. I mean, what can he do with that? But, you know, all our hope goes with Jacob Bethel. Anyway, that'll do for now. We'll come back after defeat in Melbourne and that'll be fun. But for the time being, thanks, everybody. Thank you, Ali.
Cheers, Max. Good to see you, mate.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you, Jeff.
See ya.
Cheers, Barney.
Cheers, Barney, and happy Christmas, everyone.
If you want to get in touch, ashes.weekly@theguardian.com.
You just said cheers, Barney.
Did I just thank myself?
You did thank yourself. You know, but listen, that's what Basball would make you do, isn't it?
I've unintentionally revealed pretty much my opinion of everyone else on this pod, frankly. Mm-hmm. And your contribution to the last hour, yeah. You know. thanks to me, but the rest of you, not so much.
No, absolutely right. Ashes Weekly is produced by Nick Harmon. Our executive producer is Daniel Seymour. The theme tune is by Rudy Zagadlo. We'll be back after the fourth test. Thanks, Max.
I don't think I've ever said my own name before. Literally.